Hello, everybody. Recording live from somewhere.
What's good and welcome to another episode of Skates and Plates on the Hockey Podcast Network. I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki. You can follow me on Twitter at Brandon_Rewicki or the podcast at Skates Plates Pod. All right, good to be back out of here. Hope you guys enjoyed your weekend as we head into the stretch run of the regular season. A big Jets dub over the weekend against a hated division rival and plenty to get into with just a handful of games left on a special edition of Skates and Plates because we've got a guest joining us. It's a rarity here, but we wanted to roll out the red carpet for somebody special. Joining us once again, co-host from CJOB, Tyson Rewicki. Tyson, how are we doing today?
Doing good. Another big Jets win, 2-0 at the new crib, so... You know,
that's right.
We're going to be talking a little bit of analytics. It's a small sample size, but this trend, I like where this trend's going. I like where this trend's going.
You're not allowed to move.
I love it. Anytime you can get into new crib statistics, it should set up well for the Jets on a deep playoff run. But we're talking a little bit of a deep dive and getting into the granular of hockey and the Winnipeg Jets. And I'm very happy and pleased to do so with somebody I'm sure you're all familiar with, writer of the Five Hole Substack. Very pleased to have, all the way up from the West Coast, Garrett Hole joining us here today. Garrett, how are we doing?
Doing, you know, just wonderful despite the West Coast rain and dreary clouds.
Yeah, yeah. So a normal day out there in Vancouver, right?
Normal spring day.
Yeah. Well, it was really dreary in the province of Manitoba for about 2.5-3 weeks. But things are on the up and up for the Winnipeg Jets, at least in the win column, picking up a couple points. And so I thought it would be a good time for, you know, us to have you on here. And now that we kind of know where the Jets are at going into the playoffs, pretty much locked into that number three spot in the Central, and maybe even locked into a matchup against the Colorado Avalanche, I thought it would be great to have you on and dive into some of the specifics about what the Jets can and maybe should do heading into this hopefully long playoff run. And I thought we'd get started with, well, I mean, the main topic in the city for the past 2 months, the Bone Saga of who should be up there on the top line for the forward group. Should it be Scheifele and Ehlers? Should it be Connor thrown in there? Velarde, where does he fit in? All this stuff. It's torn the fan base apart. I'm intrigued to know where you sit on this, not only just the top line as a whole, but I think what's kind of been underreported or under-talked about is just the fact that we also need to know what the second line should look like and what the best iteration of that is going up against some of these teams in the Central Division come playoff time, where it's going to take more than just a decent top line to get through a Colorado and a Dallas. So... kind of a long-winded way of just saying, what do you think the ideal forward groups for the Winnipeg Jets would look like come game one of the postseason?
Okay, how do I do this in a couple sentences or less?
Take your time.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, like, to start off, like, there's no doubts that the Jets don't have an easy path in front of them. I think Micah Blake McCurdy's website has the Jets something at like a 96% chance of facing Colorado. So it's all but solidified that they're going to be seeing Colorado. And then, you know, if they do beat Colorado, they're most likely seeing Dallas, although Dallas might lose in the first round. Weirder things have happened, but that's two teams that are very, very strong. That is not, that's not them going against any paper tigers. So you are correct. So you need everything optimized as much as possible to maximize your chances. So we can start off with the top line, since that's the one that most people usually talk about, with good meaning, because, you know, the fact that, for two reasons, because generally speaking, the top line is the most important. They're on the ice the most. They play against the top competition the most, even more so than the Lowry line. Lowry line, yes, Bones tries to get the matchups as much as possible, but when you have less ice time, you still can only do so much, especially when the other team's top line has the most ice time for their team. But also because Winnipeg has had essentially two different types of top lines this season. They've had two variations that have worked very well, and they've had four or five variations that have worked really disastrously. and those the two that have worked.
Well, let's talk about the two that worked, please.
Yeah, the two that have worked have been Mark Scheifele whenever Nikolai Ehlers is on there. Everyone kind of concentrates on the variation that had Gabe Vilardi on there, with good reason, because the Jets won a whole bunch of games during that time, and they actually were better in terms of goal differential, in terms of outscoring their opponents. But, you know, the variation with Ehlers, Scheifele, and Kyle Connor was pretty much just as good. Better in some areas, worse in some areas, but the net difference was about the same. So, you know, both of those variations really, really worked. And, you know, it is kind of funny, though, because I tweeted something similar, that everything that I know about analytics and such like that suggests to me that it shouldn't be as drastic as it has been. Nikolai Ehlers is a good player. I've supported how good he is for quite some while. But we're not like talking about like Connor McDavid here. Like I'm not putting him in that kind of level or tier. It's just kind of worked that way, that the top line has been exceptionally good with him on it, and without him on it, it has been bad. And it's not just like a small sample thing, because it is fairly consistently like that. As far back as I've gone, which is like 2016, when Ehlers, you know, was on the team. And I think some of that, especially recently, because I was trying to figure it out, because, you know, I don't just look at the numbers and just be like, okay, the numbers say this, blah, blah, blah. So I have been kind of looking into it, and I've theorized recently, especially with, you know, with the five hole, I also track data. I don't just use the NHL.com's data. I track my own data just to give to my paid subscribers, but also, you know, to analyze things better. And I think one of the things about it is actually Ehlers has a high amount of chemistry, but not with who you think. I think it's actually Josh Morrissey. Because Josh Morrissey is the guy that, generally speaking, plays with the top line. And one of the things you'll see a lot is in the offensive zone, if Ehlers doesn't have the puck, he likes to play high. And when he does that, it gives Morrissey the benefit to essentially play like the rover role, kind of like Dustin Byfuglien. And honestly, Morrissey, in my opinion, is the best player on the Jets. It's not named Connor Hellebuyck. Like, I do think like Ehlers is a very, very good forward, but like letting Morrissey do whatever the heck he wants to do, I think is one of the big reasons why Ehlers on the top line has been so successful. It's not just the fact that he is, you know, better than some of the alternatives. I think it's also because of the fact that he lets Morrissey kind of roam more in the offensive zone. So it's a theory. I don't know if it's completely true, but yeah, that's my quick thoughts on the top line.
Yeah, I'll let you jump in here, Tyson, in a bit, but just to kind of piggyback off that, do you think it's almost more important to stack Ehlers and Morrissey on the ice at the same time, as opposed to maybe figuring out where best Ehlers should fit, whether it's beside Scheifele or beside Monahan on the second line? Like, if you were Rick Bowness, would that be almost your most important internal matchup? And then you can kind of reconfigure, especially come playoff time, when it's much easier to, you know, not only line match itself, but also set your lineup in a very specific manner. Is that the one thing you kind of lean on more than anything else?
Yeah. So first, speaking generally, most analytical research has suggested that what I've suggested the Jets do is usually the wrong thing to do. So usually you want to spread out your talent. It's like the best way, it's more important to have your best guy in the top line and your second best guy in the second line. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is because then you have more ice time where you have your best guys on. And part of that is because you get diminishing results with each guy on each line. So the best player on the line is the one that drives it the most. And the second best guy, he has less of an effect. And the third guy, his total quality has less of an impact than his, like, that's when you start seeing things that are more along the lines of chemistry effects being more important and less about the quality of player. That's not completely true, but, and this is something that, you know, even coaches have known as far back as the 80s. Like, you look at the 80s, they generally speaking kind of like thought of their lines as pairs. And then they would have like the third guy being like, you know, the guy that they thought was the best role given like who everyone else is. So the analytics kind of like backs that up. Like, you know, spreading out your talent is more important. But in this specific situation, I still would like maybe not playing Morrissey on the top line or with the top line if you do want to kind of spread things out. But like in terms of like Scheifele and Ehlers, like it does seem that those two have to play together for the Jets to be successful because of the fact that, when I looked back at it, as far back as 2007, 2008, there's never been a Stanley Cup winning team that's had a top line that tends to get outscored more often than it scores. So, yeah.
Yeah. And then, so we just talked about the top line and, you know, how crucial keeping, you know, Ehlers, Scheifele, Vilardi together could be for them come playoff time. But with the additions of Monahan and Toffoli, and Monahan came over a little bit earlier, so there's a little bit bigger of a sample size for some with him, with some of the guys on the team. But how would you go about configuring that middle six there? Because the fourth line, depending on what you think for the middle six, but I think the fourth line, there's a couple pieces there where you can plop them in and out, and there's not going to be too much of a change. But how would you kind of mix that middle six there if we're rolling with Ehlers, Scheifele, Vilardi come playoff time?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of also depends on whether you're constraining yourself to the way that Bonus tends to like to constrain his lines. One of the reasons why he's been so resistant with Ehlers on the top line when Connor was there is because of the fact that he likes to have a one right-handed winger on the right side and one left-handed winger on the left side as much as possible. It's also why he's avoided Cole Perfetti being on the second line quite a bit. Given those type of constraints, with Toffoli, it's really hard to say in terms of like a chemistry perspective because of the fact that, as you mentioned, there just hasn't been a lot of sample size with him. So there's nothing that I would say with like great vindication. In terms of actual like line performance or whatever, Monahan also has done very well with Ehlers. That is just something that is the way it is because that's the way that Ehlers is. One of the reasons why Ehlers is as good as he is because of the fact that everyone tends to play better with him than away. Generally speaking, this is going to get some people a little against me because, you know, everyone's been very happy with how Perfetti's been playing on the second line. But I will say that the current second line was better when it was with Ehlers and Toffoli. The second line was also better. Sorry, I just had a brain fart, so I'm going to have to cheat and actually look up because I should know the stuff off the top of my head. Because the fact that was what my article was about today on the Bible.
blame it on the little ones. Blame it. I get that. I'm running down like 3 hours sleep, so it's the little one's fault.
I don't have kids, and I could barely remember.
Yeah, Tyson could barely function.
Yeah. Sorry. The line that I was thinking of was also had Ehlers, so I was wrong about that. I was thinking that Ehlers and Iafallo was someone else in Iafallo, so I was wrong about that. So like the Monahan line, thus far Monahan's had like four different lines that he's been with. So you have the Ehlers and Toffoli. That one was the best one thus far. Ehlers and Iafallo, that was the second best one. Then the current one, Connor and Perfetti, only the third best. They have outscored oppositions, but they've actually been outshot by the opponents. So, you know, it's not like a perfect situation like that. But one of the things that I would say, though, is that while they have been outshot, Connor, Monahan, and Perfetti, we're dealing with like very small samples. It's only been three games that the Jets have won, and you know, like you get a little bit of score effects when you're leading and such like that. And I'm not going to take a whole bunch of confidence on saying whether or not a line is great or terrible based off of a three-game sample. But yeah, so I'd say Connor Monahan is a great second line. Whether or not that person on the right side is Perfetti or Toffoli is something that I definitely would have up to debate, because of the fact that we haven't seen the second one at all. So we have like that's a zero sample size. So who knows? I would say that, you know, from not looking at chemistry and just looking at quality of player, Toffoli is a better performer than Perfetti. But you know, that, like we said, you know, it's not all about stacking your best guys. It comes into what you want to view from the third line and whether you think that Toffoli can fit in the third line when it comes to Lowry. Just because, you know, the Niederreiter Lowry Appleton line has been very, very good. One of the best third lines in the entire NHL. I'm not sure if I would say definitively that they are the best third line in the NHL, but they're definitely up there.
Is that just because of their, sorry to cut you off, Garrett, but is that just their defensive impact solely, or is there an element of offense that they're generating still?
It's the fact that the little amount of offense that, because like they definitely play a style of no offense for everyone. Like that is the way it is. It's very low event hockey.
That's how I play too.
I just play lots of offense for the other person, but that's because, you know, as a goalie playing.
Oh, that's wrong. Goal. Oh, well, it's been fun having you on, Garrett. We got to let you go.
Yeah, but nobody wants to play goalie for beer league, even though they usually get to play for free. It's just like, ugh.
Yeah.
So I tend to play defense. Nice 6'2" right shot defenseman. So I'm more of a pugilist than anything. The Niederreiter Appleton line have been, you know, they might not have a lot of shots and a lot of scoring chances, a lot of goals, but they still have more than their opposition. I will have to say though, that one of the things that was interesting when I was recently looking, so I mentioned this before we started recording, but there's a website called Puck IQ that likes to slice up data into like very small samples. So, you know, take everything with a massive handful of salt. But it was interesting to see that the Lowry Niederreiter Appleton line, while they have performed very, very well, it's mostly during their minutes that they've been playing against the middle and the bottom of the lineup where they get all their value. So they're playing against these top lines, but their actual good performance is mostly for their minutes away from those top lines, which was kind of interesting for me to see. Again, small sample, so, you know, handful of salt, but yeah, so going back to it, you know, right now Lowry's with Toffoli and Appleton and, you know, they are performing well. But one of the things that you have there is you have a weird thing going on with two right-handed wingers between Lowry, and we've seen a couple times where that's kind of messed things up. Like Appleton set up Toffoli. Is that last game or the game before? I think it was last game, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was pretty much a wide open net, and if Toffoli was a left shot guy, that probably would have went in. But you know, it's not always optimal having guys off on their offhand side. Like, you know, I kind of mentioned earlier about like coaches knowing things. Handedness is another thing that coaches know. Sometimes coaches get like, I'd say coaches are extremely, extremely adept at doing the things that they do and knowing the things that they know. It's just sometimes they kind of lose the forest for the trees. So like, for example, talking about handedness, like analytics has shown that, you know, it is preferable to have a left shot guy on the left side and a right shot guy on the right side. Now, some of that might just have to be with comfortability. So that might be slanting the results, but it does seem to be like that. But you know, when Niederreiter comes back, you know, maybe you push Appleton down a line and all of a sudden you just do Niederreiter, Lowry and Toffoli. But of course we don't have any sample size for that. And, you know, it's always a little bit scary going into the playoffs when you have a line that you want to you know, match up against the top guys as much as you can, and you don't really know how good they are because you haven't really seen them play much. So that's kind of the question there.
Yeah. And so with the way that these lines have looked, you know, over the first half of the season compared to the second half, I was just wondering, was there anything that you saw in the first half that maybe kind of was a calling card to what was to come in the second half? Or is this kind of just something the play is just dropped for whatever reason? Or is this something that maybe, you know, you and some other people might have seen coming?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a mixture. So some of the drop has occurred because the Winnipeg Jets are a team that's heavily reliant on the performance of Connor Hellebuyck. He is arguably the best goaltender of his career, over his career time. There are some people that are within reaching distance to at least be debatable about, but he is ahead of those guys in terms of most metrics that I would care about. And so, like, most analytics suggest that the Jets are kind of like a 10th, 11th place team with arguably the best goaltender. And so, but the problem is with goaltenders is there's a kind of common phrase that a lot of people hate, but I use it quite often, where goaltenders are voodoo, which is just it's usually just like, to a lot of people will say that it has, I'm sorry, I apologize. To go back, goaltenders are voodoo. A lot of people don't like that saying because they believe that that means that we don't know anything about goaltenders, which is not true. What we're saying with goaltenders is the fact that even the best goaltenders play really bad, and they can play really bad over a very long period of time, because there's a lot more volatility to goaltending. So just to give you an example, another former Winnipegger, Gabriel Desjardins, he did an investigation on how often a 920 save percentage true talent goaltender, so basically a guy like Hellebuyck, someone who's going to the All-Star game quite often and getting Vezina touches and stuff like that, plays versus a 900 true talent goaltender, aka someone who's like an AHL call-up talent. And over a span of 10 games, if you just took a random 10-game sampling of each one of the guys, one-fifth of the time, the 900 goaltender would be better. And that's kind of wild, because, like, think about this. Like, how many spurts of 10 games do you think Morgan Barron is better than Connor McDavid? Like, none. Like,
I'll take the under.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. But, like, that's just the way goalies are. It's just, in part because the gap between them is so little, but also because of the fact that, you know, it's a thing, it's a position where one or two mistakes just drastically changes your performance. You make one flub, and then all of a sudden, you know, you just look terrible, even though you're good 98% of the time. It's just the way it is. So, I mean, all of a sudden, Connor Hellebuyck he was being a little bit more human, and he wasn't stealing the games for the Jets that he was always stealing. And so they weren't able to win quite as often. Now, they also were not playing as well. I don't like beating up on the guy because I think he's a good player, even if he is flawed and limited. But there is, it's not randomness that the Jets' defensive metrics all started to go downhill after Kyle Connor was healthy and was put onto the top line. Kyle Connor is an extremely efficient and extremely good goal scorer, but defensive player, he is not. And Nikolaj Ehlers is not a great defensive player either, but at least Ehlers is a better transitional player, so he plays defense less often. I saw a good quote where someone said, like, the same reasons that makes Kyle Connor really good in the defensive zone, soft puck touches and sometimes becoming invisible, is the same reason why he's pretty bad in the defensive zone. So there was a little bit of, we kind of expected it, and there's a little bit of, you know, it's just the way the cookie crumbles sometimes.
We're speaking with Garrett Hole. You can check out his work at the Five Hole Substack, talking Jets line combinations and D pairings heading into the postseason. I agree there, Garrett. I think that's kind of what's lost in the Ehlers-Connor debates of the last, you know, handful of years here, is that I actually believe that, you know, having Kyle Connor on more of a sheltered scoring line, it's not, shouldn't be seen as a punishment, more so as you're doing something to accentuate his strengths and potentially get the most value that you can out of him. But I do want to shift gears to the blue line, because that's obviously going to hold a big, big portion of the team's either success or failures come playoff time. I feel like, surprisingly, the entire fan base is in agreement. Morrissey, DeMello is your top pairing heading into game one of the playoffs. Just what do the other four look like? What would be the Jets? At the very least, I think we kind of know what they're likely to look like. But I guess the better question would be, what would be the most optimal pairings for the Jets after Morrissey and DeMello go 1-2?
Yeah, I mean, Morrissey, DeMello, they've been great. They're great together. They're great against tough competition. They're great against weak competition. And they're the guys that get the hard matching, and they do well. After that, it definitely gets difficult. The Jets are in a weird situation where they've leaned heavily. Not until recently, they've played almost the exact same pairings for almost every single game, except for like the odd ones where they switch Schmidt and Stanley, or the couple of games where Dylan was either sick or suspended. So like Dylan was sick for one game. He was suspended for three games. And then you had the first two or three games of the season where he was paired with Sandberg. Other than that, they've pretty much been Neil Pionk with Brendan Dylan and Dylan Sandberg with a rotation of Stanley or Schmidt until the trade deadline. So, you know, you're not talking with a huge amount of confidence and with, you know, how things have gone in terms of, a great deal of confidence with, you know, making assumptions of how things should be based off of how things have gone. We do know this. Brendan Dylan and Nate Schmidt do not play very well together. So we started off the season with Sandberg in the top four being paired with Neil Pionk, and they actually did very, very well. But the problem was Dylan and Schmidt were a disaster, and they've both been pretty good players for their role throughout the season. But they just play very poorly together, mostly because of the fact that no one is really moving the puck when they're out on the ice. So that makes things a little awkward. Some people would be surprised to hear that when Sandberg is with Schmidt, Sandberg is actually the one that does most of the transitional play. Schmidt is a little bit more offensive in terms of when the Jets are already in the offensive zone. He's more likely to join the cycle. He's more likely to jump up in the play and such like that. But Sandberg is actually the transitional guy for that partnership. So, but either way, whether Sandberg's with Schmidt or whether Sandberg's with Pionk, things are pretty good. The problem is Dylan and Pionk are not a very great second pair. And I think Dylan is a good enough player that could be on the second pairing, but him with Pionk doesn't work out so well. Sandberg with Pionk has worked well in the second pairing role, but we're talking with a small sample size, so who knows if that just would regress, because it's not like Sandberg is exceptionally different style of player than Dylan. He's just a little bit better of a puck mover and a little bit better of a skater, but not as aggressive and not as physical. Now, maybe that is why Sandberg works better with Pionk, because Pionk moves the puck a lot, but he doesn't move the puck very efficiently. So like I said, I track a lot of data myself manually, and Pionk gives up the puck relative to how often he has it, more often than any other defenseman on the Jets, which makes he's a pizza machine, essentially. He likes to give lots of pizza deliveries. And that's it, to take a Claude Noel phrase. But yeah, it makes things kind of difficult to really figure out what is optimal. I wish the Jets kind of tried Colin Miller more, because the fact that he is a right shot guy, his metrics on the Jets haven't been the greatest, but you know, he's only played a couple of games, very spotty usage, and his actual results from he's made a name of himself for the past like 5 or 7 years because of the fact that he's generally speaking a guy that actually gets very good results relative to his ice time and relative to the perceptions of him as a player. So I kind of wish that the Jets really tried him a lot more with Brendan Dillon to kind of see if the Jets could, instead of having like a first pair, second pair, and third pair, they kind of had like a almost like a 3A and a 3B or a 2A or 2B, depending on how you looked at it. And they kind of would do Dillon with Miller and Sandberg with Pionk. Because, you know, maybe Sandberg and Pionk, because Sandberg and Schmidt has worked very well. But the problem is the Jets are not going to sit Pionk. This seems to be the way that he's the third in ice time. Bonus seems to have a lot of confidence in him. I'm not certain why. There's a lot of things that Pionk does do very well.
Would you sit him?
Sorry?
Would you sit Pionk?
I would at least try sitting Pionk just to see how things go. I mean, some people have talked about the fact that he looks like he might be injured based off of his skating mechanics recently. But the only problem that I have with that kind of like hypothesis is the fact that this is how Pionk has kind of been performing for about 3 years now. So I personally would sit Pionk. I think that the Jets could do much better, but the problem is I wouldn't sit Pionk going to the Stanley Cup playoffs. I would be sitting Pionk midway through the season so that I can get a better handle of what I have otherwise, so that I can make a better decision for the Stanley Cup playoffs. And that's kind of the problem that we're at right now, because like we really don't know if there is a second Jets pairing that can take top 4 minutes and win those minutes. Because yeah, Sandberg Schmidt been great, but it's been very sheltered minutes. Sandberg Pionk been great and actually second pairing minutes, but we're talking about I think 6 or 7 games. No one's really seen Miller, and if you're putting Dillon with DeMello, it worked out pretty decent, but Morrissey and Pionk weren't so great. So yeah, it's a tough call.
Well, and like
you, solution, sorry.
But like you, and like the Jet, you traded for Colin Miller, right? So like, yeah. Why not at least see what you have with him? It just seems like there's been a little bit of a hesitancy, even with Logan Stanley getting minutes. I know they're two different kind of D men, but I find it really odd that Colin Miller's not getting at least a little bit more of a shot, especially after you go out and get him.
Yeah, it's very. Sometimes coaches and GMs don't have the same kind of thought going on. And, you know, maybe that is what it is, or maybe this is the role that they brought him in as just like extra NHL depth. Who knows? I'm not in that room. I can't say for sure. I do think it's interesting that Mike from the Winnipeg Free Press, like after they got traded or after they traded for Colin Miller, he said that like, oh, maybe, you know, like that's where he slotted Miller, because he thought like, you know, maybe that's where it'd be. And I was like on the second pair with Brendan Dillon. And I was like, yeah, that's a kind of like neat spot. Like put Sandberg and Pionk on the third pair. And then all of a sudden you have, you know, maybe if you kind of spread out the toughs for those two guys or those two pairings, maybe it'll work out. And then you can figure out, you know, which one would work. But unfortunately that's, you know, not what's happened. And, you know, at the same time, he keeps up. Bonus keeps on lamenting about the fact that he's having to put two lefties out there, but he's got a righty that's sitting in the press box.
Yeah. I mean, it makes for some interesting decisions in these last 4 or 5 games leading into that. Like you said, 96% chance of facing the Avalanche in round 1. we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, Garrett. It was a great conversation. People here in Winnipeg, they'd love to chat about what they feel like would be the best lineup. So we've given them a little bit of ammo to work with. Just quickly here before we wrap things up, since we can assume that it's Jets Avs round one, do you have a bit of a prediction? We don't have to do, you know, how far the Jets are going to go, because there's potentially a lot of change that can happen after round one of the postseason. But just looking at Jets Avs, if you've got a minute here, what are your kind of early leanings on that matchup?
Well, to start things off, when it's given the choice facing the Avs or the Stars, I personally prefer the Avs. Partly analytical, but partly just gut wise. Just because I feel like the Avs are, you know, the kind of more play in a manner that I think the Jets can play against. And because of the fact that I feel that analytically speaking, the Jets can match up better against them, because in terms of shot differentials and scoring chance differentials, the Avalanche are a little bit less strong than the Dallas Stars. The Dallas Stars are more of a guys, more of the guys who beat you by outchancing and outshooting you, while the Colorado Avalanche are more of a guys who don't get as many chances as they get a lot of chances. Don't get me wrong. I'm just mean relative to the Dallas Stars. Mm-hmm. But they're more of a more elite finishing. And I think that is a better matchup for a team that has someone like Connor Hellebuyck. But at the same time, the last time where I said something like that, I was like, yeah, the Jets would be a much better matchup to face the Montreal Canadiens than the Toronto Maple Leafs. And then we all saw how that worked. Yeah. You know, you're like, you know, when we're dealing with probability is not destiny, so you never know. There's always that going on. So but yeah, I think the Avs are a team that the Jets can definitely play against, and I think they can play well against if they are optimizing their roster efficiently, and not, you know, putting a top line that has been both outchanced and outscored, especially against tough matchups. And, you know, the Colorado Avalanche are a pretty deep team. And depending on the health of Rantanen, might only get deeper. I'm going to say Jets in six.
Ooh, I like that. I like it in an episode with a spicy meatball take, and one that's full of optimism too. So why not we cap it off there, and we'll head into these final few games with that thought marinating in our heads. Garrett, thanks again so much for joining us. For anybody that's interested in finding out your work, just let them know where they can check out all the great stuff that you're coming out with.
Yeah, so I have a Substack, which is kind of like a blog / newsletter. Generally speaking, Substack cuts off your email newsletter after it gets a certain length of time or certain length. And I generally speaking go over that length. So it's more of a blog that gives you an email notification. every Monday and Friday I have posts for my free subscribers, and then for the paid premium tiered subscribers, you get a third post on Wednesdays. And those third posts have like stuff about, you know, that data that I'm tracking manually, and also a little bit more in-depth deep dives. So yeah,
great stuff. Well, again, thanks to Garrett Hold for joining us.
You're the man, Garrett.
We can check out all this great work at the Five Hole Substack. But that's going to do it for the episode here today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in once again, the Skates and Plates of the Hockey Podcast Network. I'm your host, Brandon Rewicki, with CJOB's Tyson Rewicki again. We'll be back at it to wrap up the week Friday morning, breaking down the start of the gauntlet for the Winnipeg Jets. Matchup Tuesday night against Nashville, and then we'll break down a beauty against the Dallas Stars in Texas for you guys Thursday night. So we'll talk Jets Preds, Jets Stars when we get back at it to wrap up the work week. Until then, though, have a great next couple of days. Enjoy the warm weather. We'll talk to you soon, everybody. Peace.